I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Pocket Limp podcast. I'm Rick Henderson, and we have somewhat a beer and entertainment theme this week. Regular host and Pocket Limp founder Stuart Miles will be here for both our news chat and to review Sky Glass, an all-in-one TV solution that offers the full Sky experience but without needing a satellite dish. I'll also be chatting with the CEO of Pinter about the company's eponymous device that attempts to make home brewing your own beer easier and more accessible, ideal for the holiday season. But first, in a week when Tiger King came roaring back onto our screens, multiple streaming services have dominated the news. Peacock arrived in the UK via Sky, Paramount Plus pulled its Star Trek content from Netflix for a future European rollout, and Disney Plus had its own day of celebrations in the form of Disney Plus Day. Stuart joins me now to discuss the different goings-on. So Stuart, first tell me about Peacock coming to Sky TV customers.
Yeah, so Sky is continuing its rollout of trying to support as many platforms as it can. Obviously, over the last couple of years, we've seen not only Netflix and Amazon Prime Video and Disney Plus, but all of the big TV stations in the US coming up with their own sort of viewing streaming app as well. And so the latest is Peacock. Now, Peacock is NBC, Universal. So you're getting things like 30 Rock, you're getting things like House, and then the Office, the American version of The Office, Parks and Recreation. There's a lot of TV shows that aren't necessarily cutting edge, like brand new shows that have still got series to run, but it is a good chance to catch up with all your favorites from, like, you know, 30 Rock and things like that.
I mean, this was a possibly a surprising move, but also a fairly obvious one in the fact that NBC Universal is also owned by Comcast, that owns Sky. So this is actually excellent for Sky customers because it's actually free, isn't it?
Yeah, it's free. It's included in the Sky Glass and Sky EPG, Sky Q EPG. So you're just, you can either access it via a pseudo app. It's not actually an app that's in a similar way of like iPlayer would be, but you can just go in and access all the content, or you can just start, you know, pressing, you know, voice search and say 30 Rock or Bates Motel or something, and off it will go. As I say, the good thing is because it's all part of that same thing, you will get every episode of 30 Rock, or you'll get every episode of The Real Housewives or things like that. There's also some movies on there. The movies are pretty, again, it's not exactly blockbuster stuff. There is the promise of new things coming, but there's some classic favorites like Bird on a Wire, starring Goldie Hawn and Mel Gibson.
I noticed also that there are some new Peacock originals. Now, This is a big push for Sky, is to have its own Sky Originals, Peacock Originals, and other original content coming to the platform. And amongst the Peacock Originals, I noticed that one of the ones coming up in the future is the remake of The Prince of Bel-Air, just called Bel-Air, which is a dramatization. It's not funny, and it's executive produced by Will Smith, not starring Will Smith. But this is not a bad thing for Sky customers, is it?
It's certainly something that it's clearly in their roadmap of adding this. They've also done a deal with Paramount Plus to get all their content on there. So that's kind of effectively, that's all the Star Trek stuff. You're already starting to see this, but because of the way licensing, and this is where it gets really boring, but because of the way licensing works around the world, different shows have different commitments to different services, and you'll see them dropping around. We saw this a lot with Disney over the last couple of years, when they were shifting all of their Marvel shows off of Netflix and other places to bring them to Disney Plus. And we'll see this with things like Star Trek, where it will, you know, at the moment it's kind of on Amazon, or it's on CBS, or it's on Netflix, or different shows. And I presume what will happen is it'll all merge into Paramount Plus. The good news is that platform is also coming to Sky, so that's a benefit there. And Sky also announced in the last week or two that they're getting Apple TV support as well, so people will be able to watch The Foundation or Ted Lasso or things like that. The problem comes, I suppose, in the near future, is that is just trying to remember which service has which show. And so it's one of the things that Sky's tried to solve with Sky Glass, for example, their new sort of streaming TV service, is, you know, this idea, and they'll try and do it with Sky Q as well, is to try and sort of really use those recommendation pages on the home screen to sort of try and alert you to the fact that this show is here and it's on this channel or this service. Because otherwise you just, you know, a lot of the time I use an app called Just Watch, where it kind of like, right, where is that, before I go and search each individual service that I subscribe to be able to, you know, find out where it's supposed to be on.
Actually, I'll go back a little bit. Is you mentioned the Star Trek stuff, and that was a big deal this week. There was a big sort of hoo-ha over Twitter about the fact that Paramount has pulled Star Trek Discovery from Netflix, nor is it putting the new series of Star Trek Discovery on the platform. And in fact, while it is now being released in the US on TV itself, on terrestrial TV, it's not coming to the UK or Europe until 2022. Mm. However, we have discovered that that is going to be on Sky, thanks to the Paramount Plus deal, which means that you'll get it actually at no extra cost to your existing Sky Q, Sky Glass, or other Sky subscription.
Yeah, and I think it's that constant battle. If you're launching a new streaming service, such as like Paramount is with Paramount Plus, you want to make sure you've got all the great content on it to encourage people to sign up to it. And so therefore you're going to turn around and say, well, you know what, we're going to pull it from the other places, because we want, if you're a massive Star Trek fan, then we want you to sign up to Paramount and pay us the money to watch it, rather than watching it through Netflix and then we get a cut from that and all the other stuff. So as I say, we saw it with Disney. Luckily, Disney's got enough content through its, you know, historical Marvel and Star Wars and Disney movies and all the shows that it's created to be able to get away with that. The question is whether Paramount or Peacock or all of these other sort of what I would call tier two services have enough content and enough pull to encourage you to want to watch these things. When, you know, how many times, you know, you might find that you watch an episode of Star Trek Next Generation from 20 years ago, but are you going to say, I'm going to subscribe £10 a month to do that for the next year, 2 years or whatever? You've got to keep on coming up with new content and using those IPs that you've already got.
And in fact, that leads us on to our last subject, which is Disney Plus Day. We had Disney Plus Day as well in the last week, and that threw up a hell of a lot of new content. That was pretty spectacular from Disney. Anything catch your eye amongst the lot?
I mean, winter's coming, to quote Game of Thrones, which is not a Disney title, but it's, you know, it's the idea where the nights are getting longer, and so therefore you're all going to be wanting to watch TV. I think the big thing from Disney the Disney Plus Day was just the sheer extent of, to me, the sheer extent of the amount of Marvel TV shows that are slated to be coming over the next year. Forget the sort of the Marvel universe, cinematic universe, with Spider-Man and Doctor Strange and all those kind of, you know, titles that we're already expecting. If you're going to want to follow up and keep track of the Marvel universe storyline, you're going to have to watch a lot of TV. It feels like there's She-Hulk, isn't there? There's the Moon one. It just seemed to be a lot of shows. I think Iron Fist is another one, wasn't it?
Iron Heart. Warrior or something. Iron Heart.
So it's one of those things where I think, you know, if you like that kind of stuff, you are going to be spoilt rotten with great content that's coming. And they all, you know, they all think, but they did launch about 15 shows. And I was just, my son and I were just like, that's a lot of TV we're going to watch in the next couple of months. So I think that's, you know, and that's partly some of the problem we've seen. I think what's going to happen on the streaming side of things, certainly from a content point of view, is we've had 2 years of everybody being, you know, mostly at home watching stuff. They've probably watched everything they want to watch. There was a delay in obviously production for making these things. But everybody, all of those companies have all said, look, everybody's clearly enjoying this stuff. We're going to make more shows. And so suddenly you're going to get a real glut of shows coming out. Some are going to be amazing. Some are just going to be average. But there's just going to be, I think a lot of people will have that fear of, oh my God, I've got so much TV to watch because everybody's telling me to watch this episode or that series or that film or what have you. And you just, you know, you can't fit it all in.
Still to come, we look at Sky Glass, the all-in-one TV, sound system and Sky streaming solution that comes dish-free.
The problem is that majority of us have gone through this whole like separate thing with our television, right? Trying to get the best soundbar or the best amp or the best screen or all these different things to make it as good as it can be. And this will never compete with that. And Sky acknowledged that.
Now, though, with numerous lockdowns shutting pubs at times in the last year or so, home brewing has undoubtedly grown as a pastime. Newcomers to the world of beer making have dabbled with buckets and yeast to make their own fresh ale. But if you were put off by the faff, there's a stunningly easy way for you to join the fun. Pinter released its first device 12 months ago and has since followed up with the Pinter 2, an easy home brewing solution that takes relatively no time and comes with its own tap on the front to pour fresh pints. I talked with the CEO of the company, Ralph Broadbent, to find out what drove him to create the Pinter and how it differs from rival beer pouring gadgetry. I started by asking him to explain the Pinter concept.
Yeah, so it's been quite a journey, actually. So Pinter gives you fresh beer at home. And I think with that, there's probably like three or four really important benefits that come with that. So, for people who aren't familiar with it, that, like, beer's not like wine. What wine gets better with age, or most wine does to a degree, but beer doesn't. You know, 99% of beer starts going off the moment it goes in a can. And, it's not a personal viewpoint. That's just a fact. And you could ask any brewer. And most craft beer cans, if you look at the back of them now, they'll say drink fresh. It's basically very difficult for supply chain reasons for breweries to get you fresh beer. What the Pinter does, it allows you to make the beer at home. So that as soon as it's ready, you can drink it. And that's how you get the freshest taste and all the freshest flavours. So from that, there's a few big benefits that come out. We ended up being the only beer in the world that can be delivered through the letterbox, which is really helpful because that means there's quite a big reduction in packaging. So 17 cans or bottles of beer are replaced by just one fresh press, which is a lot smaller. We're only transporting about 15% of the original liquid, something like that. And it fits through a letterbox. And so it's just way better for the environment. So we've only been trading for about a year and we've stopped about 3 million cans or bottles from going to the waste stream. So in addition to the quality benefits of fresh beer, there's big, big environmental benefits. And we're lucky in the UK that making beer at home doesn't carry any duty. So you might expect, something like 30 to 60% of a product customer duty, depends on the beer and all that sort of stuff. But with this, there's no duty. So whenever we make a beer, what our approach is basically, we say to the brewers, right, just make the best beer you can. If you need to use the best hops in the world that have been growing for 2,000 years, then so be it. We just want the beers to be amazing. So we never think about cost when we develop our beers. We just think about quality. And we're able to do that because we're only transporting a fraction of liquid, so it's big logistics savings, but also because there's no duty on the product as well. So the consumer ends up with better value. We've got a mountain to climb because it's a whole new way of drinking, we're trying to bring to the world. But I think that's probably a reasonable assessment of the benefits of Pinter.
Well, there are other sort of like beer pouring devices that have come out in the last few years. But with Pinter, you deliver the basic ingredients, but already pre-mixed brewing your beer. And then the Pinter itself is kind of the brewing vessel, if you like.
Yeah, so what I'd say the Pinter really is, so brewing is quite an evolved process, and obviously it takes a long time to become a good brewer, and I think probably most of the tricky part of brewing is actually in the creation of the wort itself. So you take actually the really raw ingredients, all the grain, all that sort of stuff, and you mash it up, and getting that formula right is a big challenge of brewing. So we do all that all centrally, where we have a team of master brewers. That's all done centrally. We take out the water to make it transportable, and then when you get it, you add the water back in, and then you do the fermentation yourself at home. So that allows you to get really fresh beer without the risk of getting it wrong, which a lot of that comes in those early stages. I think what we're trying to do, like, this isn't the Pinter's not a product for like experienced brewers, I wouldn't say, although we do have a lot of experienced brewers that use it. You know, that's not how it's designed. It's designed to be something for Joe Blocks, who can have a go at having fresh beer at home for the first time. So simplicity is at the heart of our design. So we work really hard to always design out any areas of risk, whatever that might be, just to make sure you're getting consistent good beer every time. But the big difference versus the pouring devices are that, I mean, the pouring devices, I mean, I always feel like products are good for, you know, most products are good for, you know, different people in different ways. The pouring devices, they have the advantage that your beer is ready to go. So if you're looking for a beer today, you know, the pint is never going to be the right solution. The pint does require a degree of planning. But the pouring devices don't give you fresh beer. In fact, you'll probably get fresher beer out of can, because they're quite long-winded, the supply chains that end up delivering the beer on the pouring devices, you know, like the Sub, for example. And so they don't have the benefits of fresh beer. So you don't get the environmental benefits, you don't get the fresh benefits, you don't get the value savings. In fact, your beer, if you have a pouring device, is probably more expensive than if you bought it out of can, whereas, like, we're the other way around. So we have a set of benefits. You don't get a pouring. Like, I think on the face of it, it feels like the pouring device is similar to the pinter. In some ways, I feel like cans are closer to the pinter than the pouring device is, because the pouring device doesn't have the set of benefits that the pinter brings. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, that absolutely does. And also, the pinter does have a handle on it as well. So it's a bit like having a keg once your fermentation is done.
Yeah. So I think you know, we're quite, you know, the experience of a pinter is meant to be really special, and obviously let people decide for themselves whether they agree with that or not. But we put a huge amount of effort into making sure that, you know, the beer that you have out of a pinter is actually just a lot more special than any other platform. And if you, like, when I always talk to the team about it, I always say, like, if you were having a load of mates over for a barbecue on, like, a Saturday afternoon, and you were drinking, you know, whatever you're into, whether that's BrewDog or Stella or whatever you're into, you know, that's a great experience. You know, you're out with your mates, you're having a load of beers at a barbecue, maybe that's an 8 out of 10 experience. But if you're drinking fresh beer that's made by you, it doesn't make the day, but it just takes it from an 8 to a 9, just like it would do if you're having some mates over and you're having good food. You know, it's not the food that makes the evening, is it? You know, it's the time that you're having with your friends, and having good quality food makes that experience more special, doesn't it? And I think that's what the pint is about. You know, it's about, and the way it's designed to share it centrally. So as you talked about, you have a tap, so, you know, you're engaging with this, with the pinter, and, you know, you're talking about it and you're trying the fresh beer that you've made, and it just enhances those special moments and takes it to the next level. So you're right, the handle is a really important feature, and we put a lot of effort into making sure that feels special, you know.
There, you've recently launched the Pinter 2, which is a second generation. What's the difference between the first and the second?
Yeah, so there's sort of three key things that we did with Pinter 2. So first and foremost, when we talk about beer degrading over time, one of the things that suffers the most is the hops. And again, this is just a sort of a fact, it's not a personal opinion. Like, if you want to speak to brewers, and you had a can of IPA that was 6 months old versus one that's straight out of the brewery, that they will be like chalk and cheese. They'll be very different beers because the hops just degrade so much over time. And with Pinter 1, we were providing stuff fresh, but it was still going through fermentation. And hops don't really like going through fermentation. You know, really the ideal thing is to add in post-fermentation, but that no one in the world is able to achieve something where you're at your home and you have a freshly hopped beer. You know, by a can, you don't add anything to it, do you? So, and there were some technical challenges to achieve this, because you don't want to let the pressure out, and, you know, you don't want to introduce any sort of horrible bacteria and all this sort of stuff. So anyway, we've invented something called the hopper, and that works with Pinter 2. So you can freshly hop your beer. So after it's fermented, you add the hopper, and the hopper basically has this dosing mechanism that injects these hop oils into your beer, and the flavor improvement is actually really dramatic. You know, it's, you physically can't have a beer like that's good at home, because you can never achieve those hop flavors in the home. You know, I say it's like going to a tap room. You know, like, I think a tap room will always be the best beer experience you can ever have, because you go to a tap room, you've got the master brewer who's freshly hopped the beer, and, you know, £10 million worth of brewing equipment, you know, that's all, you know, a decent tap room will always have, that'll always be a really great beer experience. But this is like trying to bring the tap room into your home, take all those benefits and bring it into your home. So anyway, so the Hopper was a really important adventure for us. We also invented this new tap system as well that essentially, when you ferment the beer, you produce a load of CO2, and the CO2 sits there in the headspace, that helps carbonate the beer. Now with generation one, with pint of one, what you did was when you went to tap, you would open the carbonation dial at the back, and that would let the CO2 escape. And the reason you had to do that was because if you tapped under pressure, you'd end up getting a load of froth. And so you had to equalize the beer, and then you can pour a nice pint. But the disadvantage of that was that as you started pouring, you start letting air in. And air is one of the number one enemies of beer, basically. It will start to oxidize and your beer will start to go off. So we gave customers 7 days to drink their beer. But the new tapping system means that we can pour at pressure. So we basically take we take the beer at pressure. It's about, by the time you've conditioned it and stuff, it's about 1.5 bar, something like that. And you bring it through 2.5 meters of coiled up tube. And the skin friction that's exerted on that as it travels through means that when it gets to the exit and you're pouring the pint, you're getting a nice pint, even though you've poured at pressure. But then as you lose pressure, as you start to tap off the beers, it comes through there's a different exit mechanism that it comes through. So when you've lost low, you've poured 8 pints and you've lost the pressure, it's still giving you a nice pint because there wouldn't be enough force to take it through the full 2.5 meters. So this tapping system is really important because it means you never introduce air. And it basically means the beer stays carbonated for longer and fresher for longer as well. So that's a really important mechanism. And I think probably overall, though, the big thing about Pint of One, the other big thing about Pint of One and Pint of Two was, you know, Pint of One was designed by four of us who had zero product design experience, basically. You know, we just set out to do something that, you know, we probably massively underestimated the project. But, you know, naivety is helpful sometimes, isn't it? Anyway, we finally got it to market. You know, as soon as we got to market and customers started using it, we sort of realized maybe these things should have been done. You know, the way the brewing dock clicks on, for example, you know, those kind of features. And our team grew really fast. We went from 6 people to 211 people in like 16 months. It was like, you know, the business really grew very fast. And as part of that, the thing that I was really keen to make sure we grew was the product development team. So we started recruiting people from, you know, Dyson, from the best agencies we could find. And we built this incredible team who are far more talented than me, or, you know, well, maybe not the other designers who worked on it, but certainly me. You know, they really knew what they were doing. And what that ended up manifesting itself as is just a product that's a lot more robust. So when you click the pinter, the brewing dock onto the pinter, that feels 10 times nicer on pinter 2 than it did on pinter 1. You know, when you're using it, it's just much more robust. You know, the lifetime of pinter 2 versus pinter 1 is something like 30 times longer. It's you know, because we do this advanced cyclic testing on it. And it's just in so many ways such an enhanced product. And that really stems from the fact that we've got better people working on it, I think, probably. So there's a load of niggles, let's say, that they are ironed out with Pinter 2 that were there in Pinter 1.
Are there other ideas for gadgets? Not necessarily from yourself, but could the brewing industry help sort of like grow or embrace technology a bit more, do you think?
Yeah, 1,000,000%. Like, you know, I think we've obviously just had COP26, haven't we? And like, I think, you know, brewing is not sat there as like one of the things that's causing global warming, but like, I feel like every industry has its part to play, you know, like we will never ever achieve net zero or the things we need to achieve if everyone relies on all the advancements coming in aviation, for example, or something like that. Everyone's got to play their part. And I just feel like the brewing industry hasn't really moved along. Do you know what I mean? Like, you look, say, BrewDog, you know, all their work's actually around offsetting. Like, you know, there's a lot of massive building projects that they're doing and things like this, which are very carbon intensive. And it's brilliant that they're like, you know, trying to pioneer this space. But fundamentally, they're still setting out to ship around cans and bottles of beer, which, are, you know, I mean, I honestly think in 10 years' time, right, you'll look back at this and you'll say, I had a glass bottle or a metal can in my home for consuming 330 milliliters of liquid. Like, that's nuts, isn't it? Like, you know, if I go to my office today, I'll look around every single person would have bought a reusable water bottle to work. They'll go to that effort to make sure they're not using a plastic bottle in the office environment. And then you might sit at home and sit there, you know, have some mates there and have a bin bag full of waste, you know. I just think it's, I think it'll be like smoking in the office. I think when it gets fixed, we'll look back and be like, I can't believe we were so wasteful. And so, but the problem with the big challenge the brewing industry's got is that they have, you know, billions of pounds of factories that are geared up for doing this. So the idea that you're going to turn around and say, actually, we can't be shipping around cans and bottles anymore, that doesn't work. You know, that just doesn't work with people's business models. And the industries are dominated by the big players. So you end up with absolutely, basically no progress, you know, until someone comes along and says, like, we're going to try and really do things differently. And I think we're probably quite lucky that the world's changing very fast at the moment, isn't it? Like, you know, to use that example about plastic bottles in the office, you know, I think 5 years ago, if I looked around the office, everyone probably would have had a single-use container, you know. There's just a big, strong movement towards doing things in a better way, basically. And when I talk to our team about it, I just really want us to be the pioneers of how this problem actually gets fundamentally fixed. Which are the companies that are inventing the solutions that are going to be fit for a world that, you know, that is actually making a difference when it comes to like climate change and things like this, you know. Obviously, I could never equate us to someone like Tesla, but like Tesla, if you think about what they were doing 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, it was definitely like they were investing so heavily in R&D, and it was almost like, you know, electric was this thing that people talked about, but like now it's like, you look at the stats, you're like, everyone needs an electric car. That's going to have to be the future. You're not even going to be able to buy a non-electric car in the UK in the not too distant future, you know? And I feel like the beer industry has the exact same part to play, you know? And we all need to get together and come up with the solutions, you know, and not rely on other industries, you know, carrying the burden. Does that make sense, Rick?
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. Tesla is a great example of a company that seemed almost mad when it first started.
Exactly.
And finally, what's next for Pinter?
Yeah. So, I mean, following on from what you just talked about, I think it's about being relentless in the pursuit of innovation. I think what we have today, I'm incredibly proud of what we've got today, right? We've done some amazing things. It's been beyond difficult. And we've cocked so many things up along the way. I feel like if it could have gone wrong, it probably did. you know, I think we're really, really focused on innovating, really we're incredibly customer centric as a business. Like, we will go above and beyond to look after our customers. And I think when you bring these two things together, this like sense that like customers are so important and that we're really hungry to innovate for the future, it's about coming up with products that are really, really meeting people's needs, you know, that fit into people's lifestyles. You know, there's no point in us coming up with some elaborate way of making beer at home that no one's got time to do. You know, these products need to fit. People need to enjoy them. People need to love the taste. Like, the beer needs to be world class. And so what's next for Pinter is to, you know, we're obviously launching Pinter 2 at the moment, but like in the future, we'll launch future Pinters, and we'll be relentless in trying to make these products better until the whole world is basically not using cans and bottles and is drinking awesome fresh beer at home.
And so we come to our weekly review slot. This time we look at Sky's first television, Sky Glass, which comes with a Dolby Atmos sound system built in and access to Sky services over the internet rather than a dish. Both Stuart and I went to the launch of the product, but Stuart has since been playing with one at home. Stu, what do you think?
Yeah, so I've had one in my home for about 2-3 weeks now. Okay, let me just say, by being really polite and saying that it's the future of television, just not yet. And I think that's the big takeaway here. So for those who've been under a rock and unsure of what we're talking about, so Sky Glass is a 43-inch, 55-inch or 65-inch quantum dot television that has a Dolby Atmos sound system built in, and the Sky, effectively the Sky box that you know and love, also built into the TV as well. The big difference here is that it's all powered by the internet, and so you don't have to have a dish on your system. And in fact, when it first turned up, The delivery guys were like, right, we've got to set this up. We've got to plug it in for you because we need to show that the screen is working. You know, it's almost like that Hermes delivery guy where he's like, we've got to show that it's on your front door. And I was like, well, I wasn't expecting you this morning. So just set it up in my hallway and be done. And then it stayed there for a day or two. I found myself actually watching TV in my hallway. Now, the reason I did that was just to prove to myself as well that this literally was, you know, as long as you've got a power socket, then you're up and running. That's it. And that's amazing. And that's, you know, really great. And you sign in, you're done. You then sign into all the, you know, the relevant services like Netflix and Disney Plus and Apple TV. I was on an early build of that. So Apple TV was available to you as well. And you sign into those and it's all done via an evolution of the Sky Q homepage, so to speak, where it's kind of recommending things to you and all the other stuff and off you go. So I think this is where it's all going to go. The problem is that it's first generation and it's kind of day one stuff. And so there were just lots of niggles and foibles that just made it not a great experience.
Right, let's break it down into two sections. Let's first look at the hardware itself. The one minor thing I think that I thought during the launch was that it's obviously not a very high-end TV panel. So what was the pitch quality like and the hardware of that side of things?
So I think you've even in the thing you noticed when you were at the launch, it hits the nail on the head. It's okay, but it's not fantastic. It kind of makes you feel like it's, you know, if you were upgrading from a TV that's 3 to 4 years old, you probably wouldn't notice any difference, which is a shame, right? Because I wanted to be, you know, knock the socks off. Everything's a bit gray, a bit washed out. I kind of watched Marvel Endgame and, you know, that really punches. And, you know, there's so many colors going on there. And it just felt a bit wishy-washy, to be honest. And the sound, again, is so much better than you would expect coming out of a TV. But it's not amazing. And I think the problem partly might be me, and I know that's being overly kind here in the sense that, you know, I've got a Sonos soundbar in my main TV and I've got a Philips OLED television. The picture quality is stunning on the Philips OLED and the sound is amazing through Dolby Atmos on my Sonos, right? So, you know, I understand that this isn't trying to be that. You know, I think the really good way of saying it, when I was young, I had a mini hi-fi system, which had a radio, a cassette deck, a CD player, and even a vinyl all built into one thing, right? And the speakers were all there. And, you know, it was great, right? And it you know, you talk to an audiophile and they'd be like, oh, Stuart, why would you do that?
Yeah.
The problem is that majority of us have gone through this whole like separate thing with our television, right? Trying to get the best soundbar or the best amp or the best screen or all these different things to make it as good as it can be, and this will never compete with that, and Sky acknowledged that. The problem by being a mini hi-fi kind of a thing is that a lot of people will think that's great, that's good enough for me, right? And as a 43 inch, which is the model I had, you know, as a bedroom TV, it's brilliant because it does what it does. There's no box, there's no fuss, you know. As I said, put it in my hallway, watching TV in my hallway, a bit strange, but anyway. So I think from that perspective, the hardware is okay, but it's not amazing. It doesn't feel like there's a jump forward. I'm surprised they didn't do like a pro model or a plus model like everybody's doing at the moment, where it is an OLED display, you know, and it is just because certainly for the 65 inch, I just think you'd be like, oh, okay.
I think price does have to factor in. I mean, if we're talking about just as an example, just off the top of my head and being generous, a Philips OLED and a Sonos soundbar would be close to £2,000, whereas the 43-inch Sky Glass is, well, I mean, £600, something like
that. Yeah, and it's £13 a month. So, you know, from that perspective, that's why I'm saying it's good, but it's not amazing.
Yeah, I think from what I gather from reading your review, which you can see on pocketlint.com, is that it's not a device for people who are already that tech savvy.
No. Now, what's interesting is that you can get, if you've got this 43-inch TV in your bedroom, say, for example, you can get the SkyStream Puck, which is a set-top box, which when we went to the event, both you and I thought that's what they were going to do, not go with the TV.
Yeah.
They were going to go with this Puck. That is a smaller, it's like a small like Apple, half the size of an Apple TV sort of box that, again, you just plug in, connect to your TV via HDMI cable, and you get all the interface of the Sky Glass, you know, homepage and all the other things on any TV in your house.
And so so how did that work on a better TV, for example?
Yeah, so that was, again, from a, like, the concept of it is brilliant. And so that was really good, right? Because you kind of, I've got the benefit of my Philips OLED and I've got the benefit of my Sonos and all the other stuff. There are still some niggles within the software that get frustrating. And I think that's, I really do believe that, and this is the second half of the review, so to speak, is that I do believe that these will be ironed out within the next 6 months, 6 to 12 months. Because we saw the same kind of issues when we were first testing Sky Q. There was a lot of problems, a lot of hassles, but you bludgeoned your way through it, and now Sky Q is a fantastic system, right? Really good. And I think that also doesn't help that I'm a Sky Q user, so therefore going to this, you know, there were things that I wanted. You know, the good thing about the Sky Stream Puck, for example, it's 4K, it's Dolby Atmos, so it's not belittled because it's an extension on the house like the Sky Q mini boxes are, which are still only 1080p and things like that. So the software, though, it's you can't record. Now, I don't see that as a problem, but it means that if you've got things that you've recorded from a long time ago because you know they've gone from the service, like one of the other reviewers, Janice, I know, were talking about it. They haven't subscribed to Disney Plus because they've got all the Marvel movies when they were on Sky recorded on their box, and so they'd lose that, right? You also have to factor in that if you do record something, it's called playlists now, that effectively you're just bookmarking it within that service. And so if it goes from that service, which we're now seeing a lot more of, a prime example what we were talking about earlier with Star Trek or whatever, then you'd lose it from your record, you'd lose it from your bookmark, your playlist queue here as well. Disney doesn't offer the resume points that when you're watching. So if you're watching something in Disney via the interface, which makes it all feel like it's all part of the interface, when you then come out and go back in, you get booted back to the Disney Plus homepage. And so then you've got to go and find it again. All these things will be fixed. There's already, and I feel that they will be fixed, because even in the 2 to 3 weeks that I've been reviewing it, I've had a number of software updates where they've tried to enhance the picture. They've tried to solve some other things. They've added some other bits, you know, all these different things. So there's lots of stuff still coming, but just some silly things. Like I found it really hard to just watch live television. Like, I'm one of those people that, you know, at the end of the day, maybe I put the kids to bed, all the other stuff. I just want to watch some TV. And so you press the button on, you turn the thing on, and it's like, right, make a decision. I'm like, I don't want to, I just want, like, how do I get to like BBC One? And then I'll work out what I want to do after that. But just how do I get some TV? And so you then, I went to BBC One, for example, and then you press the channel up button and you have to wait 3 seconds for the next channel to load.
Yeah.
And then 3 seconds for the next channel to load. And I asked them, I said, this is mad. Oh, people don't watch TV that way. And we did it on purpose to force you into doing it this way. And so I'm like, well, that's not how I watch TV. And I think that's...
Yeah, same. I do exactly what you do.
It's called channel zapping.
Yeah.
And supposedly nobody does it.
Sky Q. No. Yeah.
So I think that's the problem. It's. I think that's why I said at the beginning, it's the future of television. There are a lot of things here that I would love Sky Q to have. There's a lot of things I think that will become second nature in the future. But at the moment, it's that first 6 months of, like, they're just trying to iron everything out. And I think it's probably best to wait just to make sure that they do, rather than taking that blind leap of faith.
So that's it for this week's podcast. I hope you find it enjoyable, even illuminating at times. If so, please leave a review on your listening platform of choice. For now, I've been Rick Henderson, and I hope you'll join us again soon. Toodle pip.